Okay. So, I'm going to continue discussing MapReduce and then give a couple of examples of using MapReduce for index construction, distributed index construction, and also computing page rank, you know, on a large scale matrix. Okay. First part, and if I get done with that, then I would shift to a next topic, which is clustering, clustering of text results. Okay, so that's the agenda for today's class. Questions before I start? Okay, so as we left last time, as I was about to leave last time, I showed this. I'm going to go over this again. So the idea is to kind of to give a brief background. MapReduce is a particular way of programming which will allow you to use large numbers of cheap machines, you know, essentially arranged in the server farms. And the idea is that you have both a map part and a reduce part. And you can think of the computation itself in terms of an abstract data type of keywords and their values. Okay, so the map part starts with a bunch of keywords and values, keys and values, not keywords, keys and values, and essentially it maps them into a set of keys and different values. So it does some computation and computes new values now. Okay. And then at this point of time, these intermediate key value pairs are reduced by first of all grouping them such that if you know, keys of the same type, all their values are combined together, are grouped together, okay, and then the reduction basically would do some computation over the group, such as adding them up, such as unioning them, such as doing some other computation. Okay, so the interesting question is if what you need to do can be written as a map task followed by a reduce task, and the number of mappings depends on the size of the input, and the number of reduction also obviously is a little less, but it depends on the size of the input. Then in essence what you can do is if you were to write that in the MapReduce form, if you can write your computation in MapReduce form, then there is infrastructure which will map that computation onto individual CPUs at the runtime. Okay, and so that's basically what the architecture, MapReduce architecture, does for you. So you, the programmer, needs to ask yourself, anything I need to do, can I write it in this MapReduce form? That's the question. And some are easy to see, some are harder to see, and much of what you need to do is, it's like you do have this huge big hammer. It's basically this humongous number of you know, servers, that, you know, cheap CPUs sitting there, and there is an infrastructure which will take any program written in the MapReduce form and, you know, schedule them onto these CPUs. I'll tell you a little bit more about those details, but eventually what this means is this is a kind of lecture which is telling you that if you were to write what you want to do in assembly language programming, here is a CPU, you know, Intel CPU, which will run this assembly language programming program for you. That's what this lecture is saying. But the rest of your life, really, you would have to write the assembly language programs. Whatever computation you have to write it as an assembly language program. And similarly for you too, most of what you will need to do if you want to use a MapReduce architecture is to write your computation as a MapReduce computation. Okay, so you have, you know, thought of lots and lots of different higher level languages. You know, you have to write something in C, a little later you have to write it in Lisp, and some of you may have written your computations in Prolog. How many have you written in Prolog? None? Okay, at least one. Okay, so these are completely different kinds of programming languages, and you have a computation and you are able to, you know, specify it in a completely different programming language and a completely different programming paradigm, right? So you have one more here, and the question is, this has some advantages. It's not meant to be a highly general purpose, but it is extremely good for certain style of tasks where the parallelism is based on the size of the input. Okay. Anyway, so the keyword and the key and value is the abstract data type that you want to think in terms of. Okay. So you reduce these into keys and values, and then these are output. Okay, that's the output of the computation. So you have to think of, can I write my what I want to do in this form? And I'll give you some examples today, but then, you know, anytime you want to do something else on this kind of an architecture, you need to think about how to write your computation this way. And really the best way to get used to MapReduce is write programs for MapReduce. You know, so if you have access, you can install Hadoop and then try to write programs for it. I'll simulate CPUs on your single machine, for example. Okay, so input is, of course, a set of key value pairs. User supplies two functions. So you only have to supply these two functions. In a map function, which takes keywords and values and gives you a list of new keywords and values. How you go from here to here, it's your body of the program. You write it. Okay? And then a reduce function, which takes keyword and a list of values corresponding to that keyword, and then gives some sort of a reduced representation of all those values. A simple thing could be adding them up. Another thing could be summing them, maybe taking the max of them, or any arbitrary computation, which somehow is a function of this list of values. Okay? Now, so this basically, so you went from KV to K1V1 and then K1V1 to V2. Okay, so these are the intermediate key value pairs. And everything is key value pairs. Okay, so the output is the K1V2 pairs. Okay, that's what you're sending out. Okay, so here is a pseudocode definition, description of counting the words in a document, counting the occurrences of different words in documents. Okay, so this map key value, the first, all it does basically is for each word W, then you emit W1. So this word occurred once. So the value is 1. W is the key, value is 1. Okay? And now, so basically after this map, so if this map will be, you know, subjected, I mean, large number of documents you have, they are going to be, you know, given, pieces of these will be given to these mapper routines. The interesting part about this map routine is each instance of this map routine might be running parallelly on a different CPU. Okay? So if you have, let's say, 1 million documents, you might basically give 100 documents to each machine. And each machine will then emit these W1 pairs, I mean the key and, you know, each word and that it occurs, each word and that it occurs. That's all it does. It's like almost trivial thing to do. Okay? But by the end of this, of all the map phases, you essentially have, you know, a whole bunch of the words that occur. Okay? And but they are in the key value format, right? Key is W and value is 1. Okay? Now all you need to do is you want to compute the number of times each word occurs. Okay, so in the reduce phase, you need to take all the W's, so notice that, you know, in the document D1, I mean, you know, here is a CPU 1, which may have put RAW 1. And it also has put RAW 1, little later, because it found one more RAW, okay. And then here's another CPU, it too put RAW 1. And so in the reduction phase, I basically have to say RAW 1, 1, 1, 1. That's my list. Okay? What? In this particular case, I'm only counting the number of words. Number of occurrences. In this case, actually, I'm just counting the number of occurrences of a word in a single document. Okay? So then basically what I can do is, I have this 1, 1, 1, and then all I need to do is I need to do, so remember that we talked about the fact that reduction takes the key and the list of values, and then gives out a value v2, okay, which in this particular case would be just addition. Okay, yes. Yeah. This is combiner, you could say. I mean, so it's a map and reduce essentially. So the in the phase where the grouping occurs, that's where this is occurring. Okay. Okay. So you have, you know, you, in this case you just added up the numbers. So it's the simplest map reduce program. We'll see one more for indexing a little later. Okay. So how this kind of a program gets, if I give you this and map and reduce, how does this get scheduled onto the CPUs? So the idea is the available CPUs are known only at the runtime. Okay, and the operating system for map reduce, Hadoop is the operating system for map reduce, for example, it essentially at the runtime decides how many you know, processors to, how many CPUs to give to the map phase, how many CPUs to give for the reduce phase. Okay. So here is basically when you give the user program, first of all you have to realize that one of the things we will keep looking at this is, notice that there should be a lot of data so that each CPU gets a piece of it. Okay, if it was a large single document, which was my problem, then I had to take the first chunk of the document, give it to one CPU, second chunk for another CPU and so on. If I have large number of documents, then presumably I will give some number of documents to the first one, some other number of documents to the second one, and so on. Okay. So the interesting thing is that so you need to think of how to split the data in such a way that these each of the pieces of the input data are handled by a separate input machine. I mean CPU. Okay, this actually is very easy in this case, you know, and it's also easy for the indexing case. But when we start talking about how to compute page rank, it's not as obvious. So I'll give you an example there that will make you think about, realize that sometimes you have to think slightly in a non-trivial direction to find out how to fit your computation into the MapReduce framework. You do this all the time. You know, whenever you have a computation to be done and you have a crazy language that you want to write this into, you need to figure out what's the best way to write what you want to do into that language. Okay, so it's just in this case, it's this scenario. So you have split the data into multiple splits, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay, and then this user program essentially, as the user program forks into multiple processes, these are the map workers, these are the reduce worker processes, and this is the master process. Now each process can be run on a separate CPU. Okay. Now the master process basically assigns each one of the, so it does the basically the mapping assignment and the reduction assignment. So which CPU does which part of the input? This is all done behind the scenes. So your life is much simpler. You don't need to know who is doing what. Okay. So it's assigning the workers, it also is assigning the reducers, okay? And then the workers then read the splits, you know, the splits that have been assigned to them, okay? And then do the local writes onto their own CPUs. Basically, it's, so it's like this part, this read is over the distributed file system. Remember last time we talked about distributed file system? So this read is over the distributed file system. This write is local write. Okay, and then this has to be done remote read again because the reducers are on a different part. Okay, you may want to reduce the latency. You might want to throw in workers, the reduction workers, to be closer to the map worker for individual, for, you know, pieces of splits that are local. Okay, that basically work on each other. Okay, that is something that the master can do, but you don't need to do any of this. This is all, if you have a better implementation of MapReduce versus a worse implementation, that's the difference, presumably. Okay, so then you have the workers, and then the workers will send out the writes again back into the distributed file system. Okay, so that's basically what is happening below you. If you were to write your computation in that MapReduce format, then this is how it gets implemented, and then you know, you can take irrespective, you don't really care about how large your data is, somebody is splitting it and then combining it and giving you the result. That's what is the point. Okay, so then all you need to do is think of how to write your computation as a MapReduce computation. Okay, so my understanding is that in most of these companies, if you join, the first 2 days they will basically tell you the libraries for using the MapReduce. Okay, and once you do that, then essentially any computation you write, you know, you have the entire server farm at your fingertips. Okay, so this is basically saying what I've already said, that input and output, final output are stored on the distributed file system. Scheduler tries to schedule map tasks close to the physical storage location of the input data, so that there will be less transmission. But that's not something that you have to worry about. Intermediate results are stored on the local file system of the map tasks. Output is often input to another MapReduce task. Okay, so sometimes the MapReduces could be pipelined. So your single computation might have multiple MapReduce pages. It doesn't have to be just one map and one reduce. Okay, so now coordination basically is, you know, this is talking about how the processes coordinate. You know, this, you don't need to again care about it. It's just figuring out once how operating system works, and then you just use it. Okay, so in this case, it's talking about how the tasks get scheduled to the machines that get available, and when the map task completes, then the CPU has to send to the master the location and sizes of the key value, the intermediate key value splits it has produced, and where they are. Okay, that is then has to be sent to the reducer, which works on that part of the data. Okay, that's what is basically being said. Okay, and every once in a while, master has to check to see if the workers are alive, or if they have signed off and gone off. Okay, now that gets us to the interesting part, which is what if the signed off and gone off? You know, there's so many CPUs working on your computation. If one of the CPUs dies, what do you do? Remember, the whole point of this architecture is it's fault tolerant. You know, individual CPUs can be dying and you still don't have to restart the entire computation most of the time. So there are different kinds of failures. If a map worker fails, then the specific tasks that are completed are in progress at that worker. Remember, master remembers which tasks, which parts of the map tasks are done by which CPU. When it pings that CPU doesn't get back, then it assumes it's dead, and then essentially it just has to give that task to somebody else. Okay, a new worker. Okay, so reduce workers will then be notified that, you know, their map would now be coming from, the map task input would be coming from a different CPU. Okay, if the reduce workers fail, then anything that's currently in progress is redone again. It's reset to idle. If the master fails, then the entire task is abandoned and you restart all over. There are different kinds of failures at least. Right? That's basically what, you know, again, it's just the obvious thing is instead of buying really fault-tolerant systems, we are buying cheap systems that are, you know, reasonable. And you are dealing with the failure. You're assuming that failure will happen. And since the computation has so much parallelism in the map level as well as the reduce level, you can handle the failures without having to restart all over again all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another map worker, basically. So the map, one map worker died. Yeah.
So when the input is ready, reducer will just go ahead and process it.
That's true. Actually, I think if as long as reduce worker is just told, it depends on, you know, it's possible that in some cases, again, I'm guessing as much as you are, in some cases, the master might already have told the reducer at the same time it is picking the map that when the map guy starts putting input and output, it would be in this position. So you can start working on the input in an asynchronous fashion. Okay? If that happens, then you need to be retold. You see what I'm saying? Yes.
Can the master switch nodes between being a map or a reduce dynamically, or is it just?
No, on a for a particular computation, you are either a map or a reduce. But then for the next computation, there are completely identical nodes. So when you become available, you go to the pool of available CPUs. And the next time, there is no separate characteristic for the map worker and a reduce worker. Then you become free. And when you become free, you go to the pool of free machines. Total commodity, basically, right? And it's fungible commodity. So, okay. And then in terms of map and reduce jobs, the idea is that the number of map jobs, so if there are M map tasks and R reduce tasks, then M and R are much larger than the number of nodes in the cluster. Basically, the idea being multiple map tasks might be given to the same CPU. Okay, one DFS chunk per map is common. You know, the way you split the map task is basically, remember the file system itself is stored as chunks. And so, you know, the size of the split is the size of the chunk. Okay. And what else do I want to say? One thing is that normally for most reasonable computations, reduced tasks are fewer in number than the map tasks. That's just the way the computations tend to occur. Okay? And so there will be fewer CPUs that would be needed for the reduced task than for doing the map task. Okay? Okay, so that's basically the background on map reduce, how it gets implemented behind the scenes. Okay, and if you're interested, obviously, as I said, the two people who worked on this at the Google, which is the first one which actually did this, is Jeff Dean and Sanjay Ghemawat. And, you know, here is a paper that you can look at for more details. And then this is just about the Google file system, which is the distributed file system with chunks and so on. If you are like an operating systems person, you know, you would enjoy this a lot. Okay. For the rest of us, what matters more is this is the computation that's being supported. So whatever I want to do, convert it into something that's supported. That's basically what you want to do. Okay. So first thing I want to do now is talk about distributed indexing. Okay. So remember, the first stage of search computation is computing is huge inverted index. Okay. How do I do it in a map reduced form? Basically, that's what I'm going to talk about right now. Okay, so the idea is that you will split the computation of inverted index. Remember, inverted index will be, there's a huge number of documents. From them, you compute the occurrence list, and then you reduce the occurrence list. You kind of unify all the occurrence lists. So in this case, you would say raw one in each of the documents. You know, in a particular document, raw is occurring, another particular document, raw is occurring. And then you want to kind of combine these occurrences and then invert them to get the inverted index. Okay. So you have two phases. One is parsing of the documents to get the word occurrences. And the reducing converts the occurrences into postings. Okay. And so that's your map and reduce. So this is your map part and this is your reduce part. This is a computation that almost is made for map reduce. There are other computations that are not, you know, as obviously made for map reduce, and so you have to think of how to make it into a map reduce task. Okay? So now each split, again, remember you need to split the input. So each split is a set of documents. Okay? So what you wind up doing is basically, so you have a situation like this, so is all the documents essentially are made into splits. Okay, and each split is being worked on by a different parser process. Each parser sends out occurrence lists, which are then put into these lists we'll talk about in a minute, and then the inverter processes will work on these to compute the inverted index posting. Okay, let me give you more details on this. So the parser, basically, the master assigns a split to an ideal parser machine. It's a map machine in this case. The parser reads the document at a time and emits the term document pair. Term occurring in the document. Parser writes the space into J term partitions. It's basically these partitions. Okay. for each range of terms, first letters. So basically, in this case, I wrote the word occurrences into A to F bucket, G to P bucket, Q to Z bucket. Okay, all the words that start with a letter between A and F will get thrown into this. All the words that start with letters G to P will get thrown into this. Okay, and notice that the same thing all other parsers do too. Okay, now having done this, now the inverter, what it needs to do is it needs to take all the A to F buckets of all the machines and then invert them. Okay, and so you only need as many inverters as there are these partitions. So if I put J equal to 3, that means I only need three inverters. Right? Okay. So obviously you might want J much larger, you know, if you want to use more parallelism. Okay, so in this case, all the A to Fs are taken and you got to, so inverter collects all the term document pairs for one term partition and then sorts them. That's where you first sort it. The mapper doesn't sort. The inverter sorts and then writes it into the postings list. Okay, so by this time you have alphabetically sorted list of words and which documents they occur in, which is your inverter index. Okay, so here is a scenario where you actually did inverted index construction using MapReduce, and it turns out to be, you know, this is about the only way. In this case, essentially, the postings are now, you know, put again to A to F, G to P, and Q to Z, and this is again, this whole thing is on a distributed file system. The inverted index itself is on a distributed file system, so they may not fit on any single CPU's memory. CPU's disk or memory. Okay, so that's how you do MapReduce for indexing. That's all you have, right? In inverted index, it's a simple task, but it's done for huge number of documents. What do you mean? I didn't understand. Parsing is picking words. How intensive can it get?
But in parsing, you are determining which document the term belongs to.
Yeah. No, but you're reading it. You're taking a document and you are setting as set document to be D1 and keep sending out words. D1, W1, D1, W2, D1, W3, D1, W1 again. Right? I mean, it may well be that you would like to think that the parsers are doing more work than inverters here, but that's okay, I don't care. They're both doing much less than really complex computations. You know, each of them, they're basically doing very simple computations. The complexity comes in the size of the input, not in terms of individual computations. Okay, and that's what MapReduce is tailor-made for. Yes? MapReduce, yeah.
But it looks like the same parser when it's done parsing can take up the work of inverting it.
No. It's not that. A parser process might be instantiated on you or him or him. And then if you got instantiated as a parser now, when you become free, you may be reinstantiated again as a parser or a reducer. Or you may not even be reinstantiated in this process at all, because the entire server farm is available, and so somebody else has a different MapReduce task for computing the page rank, and you may get assigned to them.
So, the way I said it is, there is a main program, it has two functions, one is parsing, one is inverting. So the same processor can do both as soon as the parser gets over, right?
Yeah, the parsers are, the CPUs are general purpose, but the issue is that the structure of the computation is there's a map followed by reduce. And the map workers are the parser workers here, the reduce workers are the inverter workers.
This happens parallelly.
What?
Will this happen parallelly or sequentially?
First
parsing and then inverter.
So that's a good question. So you can, I mean, all the parsing can happen parallelly, okay? And then think about what happens for the inversion. You know, if you are not waiting, there are some cases. You want to explain it to the rest of the class? That's fine, though. I think you seem to know something more. What I was trying to say is that, you know, the question was whether the parser followed by, we do know for sure that parsing is all parallel. We do know for sure that, you know, inversion is all parallel. The question of whether these have to be strictly sequential or not, that depends on the computation. Okay. The worst case assumption is that they have to be sequential. That means you have to have the parsing get done before the inversion starts working. Yeah.
Inverter will have term and list of documents.
Yes, that's what it does. Right, it is getting document and terms, and then it outputs term and a list of documents. So it changes both the keyword and the values. So think of this in terms of keyword values as the computation. Yes. My understanding is map and reduce, normally reduce is supposed to be after map. Okay.
In this case, actually, much more easier because, like, otherwise you would have to sort every time.
Exactly.
But in some cases, parallelism would be useful, like counting and something like that.
I mean, so that would still be any time computation. That means the final answer will still not be over until the entire. So the difference is whether inversion can happen concurrently with parsing. Eventually, the last step of inversion has to happen after the last step of mapping. Right? The question is whether there is going to be concurrency or not. You can allow concurrency, but the result is output only when the entire, you know, map is over. Okay? Again, the problem with this is also that, you know, most of these except Hadoop are proprietary. And I don't know how they actually implement this. Okay, and this is actually the first time I'm teaching this in the class. You know, in the past I would just say there's MapReduce, you can use it. I actually think, you know, it will be more interesting for you to write your own computations in MapReduce. It's a situation where it's become common enough that, you know, you might as well want to think about how to write your computations in this form, because that's what is supported. And in fact, there are papers that get published where much of the paper is how did we do this computation, this clustering task, as a MapReduce computation. So, and you barely ever get a paper for saying how did I write my program in Prolog. You know, nobody cares because you're supposed to do it yourself. You know, but MapReduce is novel enough that at least as of 2 years back, they were still publishing papers where if you found some interesting way of converting your computation into MapReduce, that's still worthwhile, you know, telling people. Okay. Now notice that again, this is the entire. So that's regarding the computation. This is actually a different point. This has nothing to do with MapReduce per se, but this is something that came up a couple of times in the class. The index, even as you completed the index is already obsolete. Because new files came into being, new URLs came into being, old URLs stopped becoming available. So what do? You have to reconstruct index every once in a while. What you might do typically, one simple idea, I mean there are obvious middle grounds between the simple idea and you know the. So the one extreme idea is as soon as you're done computing the index, recompute the index, right? The other idea is compute the index and do the following thing, which is essentially you have computed the index and as you get new, you maintain a big main index, okay, which is what you just computed, and any of the new documents that the crawler found since the past index has been computed, they go into an auxiliary index. Okay, and then of course you have to search across both main and the auxiliary indexes. Okay, when you're doing the actual results. Okay, now the question of course is every once in a while you have to merge this auxiliary one back into the main one, because you know, so that you'll have one single phase. And that the question is, how often do you want to do it? It's up to you. I mean, you know, you the search engine. Okay. And then somebody actually was asking about this. What happens if the at the end of last class somebody was asking this? What happens if a file got removed from the last time you crawled? This time you crawled, that file doesn't exist anymore. Okay. First of all, search engines do give links, and when you click on that link, it doesn't exist. I mean, it happens all the time. Okay. But if you actually want to keep track of, you know, sometimes they might realize that the file doesn't exist, and the next time the entire master index is constructed, that file's URL will go away. But in between, you could basically, for the deleted documents, you can put basically, you know, some sort of a flag saying this is deleted. And then and while you are about to put out the results, if any of the results happen to have a zero in that flag, even if it is number one result, you don't show it. That's one idea. Okay. So notice that this is just one simple extreme, and not ever changing every day is changing every second is another simple extreme, and there are in between. Okay. So again, as I said, these are engineering. This part of the lecture is really engineering search engines, and so it's engineering. You know, it's not. There is no proof that one way is better than another way. I mean, there are trade-offs for different ways of doing these things. Okay. So, yeah. Oh yeah, lots and lots of things get affected, of course. But again, in fact, keep that in mind. We'll get to another point hopefully soon, where we will do things for efficiency's sake, which actually change the nature of the computation we are supposed to be doing. Just keep this in mind. You know, when we talk about dangling nodes. Okay, but that's basically what you wind up taking. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about, in fact, the last thing on the engineering issues I want to talk about is computation of page rank. You know, especially if you're doing it at the global level. Remember that you could do link analysis either at the query time or before query. Okay, global versus, you know, query specific. You know, and obviously you know that right now it's computed in query independent fashion beforehand. To the extent page rank is being used at all, which I have no clue whether they're really using it or not, but they do compute it beforehand. So the question could be, how would you power iterate on a web scale matrix? You know, computation of page rank is nothing but power iteration on the matrix. Okay, except this matrix is not a 5 by 5 matrix, not a 10 by 10 matrix, it's a 8 billion by 8 billion or maybe even larger matrix. How exactly do you do power iteration on that? And furthermore, this is also a good case in thinking of using, you know, to the extent your hammer is MapReduce. That's what you have to do anything faster. How would I compute page rank in such a way that piece of the action is done by different CPUs? Okay, how do I convert power iteration such that whole bunch of CPUs can take part in them, you know? That's the question. And upfront, it's, you know, depending on the frame of mind you're coming into this task, upfront it may not be obvious as to how to split it. Okay. So let's look at the big issue, of course, is the link matrix, right? Once you have the link matrix, then you can do everything, essentially. Okay. Now, the good thing about the link matrix is it's sparse. Okay, actually it's a very interesting point that the 1-0 matrix, the adjacency matrix, is for sure sparse, right? Do you know what sparse means? Sparse means it's a matrix where most of the entries are zero. So very, very few, a small fraction of the entries are non-zero. Okay, in an adjacency matrix, most of the entries are zero unless you are in one of these scenarios where you have completely connected graph. Okay, so now the question then is, is PageRank matrix sparse? Is PageRank matrix sparse? Is M star sparse? No. So if the zeroth order mistake anybody can make is to assume that you will directly handle m star during computation. Because if you do that, you no longer have sparsity and you're dead on arrival. What you should do instead is to write your program in such a way that this is what is happening here in all these steps. You start with the link matrix and during the iteration compute the entries as on demand. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the m star came from the link matrix. Okay? So you only keep the link matrix and compute m star, the part of m star you want, and as and when you need it. The link matrix is sparse, m star is not. Okay, again, this is something that it's not worth spending time on in a conceptual sense. You know, what's the big difference? You know, there is a link matrix, there is the stochastic matrix. But it makes all the difference as to whether your program will actually run or not, because one is non-sparse, one is sparse. Okay, so this is Bill Gates is moving on. So if you have a sparse matrix, like the link matrix, this is how you would essentially, this is one data structure you can use to represent that matrix. Okay, so imagine that all the nodes are given unique IDs, all the URLs are given to unique integer IDs. Okay, I need to stop this. I'm not even sure whether I can stop it. Does anybody remember? Oh, this one, right? Slideshow. Don't use rehearsal. I didn't even rehearse, believe me. I know why it is. Because this comes from a talk given by Tahir Haveliwala, who actually, came up with this idea for computing page rank efficiently. And so presumably he did rehearse. And so it's using his rehearsal timings. But anyway, so you have this already. This is a huge improvement over full M star. So you only keep the link matrix. So here all you're saying is this is my source node, and the source node has the out degree 4, that means there are 4 links it is pointing to, and the link and nodes it's pointing to are 12, 26, 58, and 94. Okay? And then similarly, 1 has out degree 3, and it's pointing to 5, 56, 69, and 2 is out degree 5, 1, 9, 10. This is your matrix representation. And if you have this information, you can compute page rank. Right? Okay, so basically all this is doing, and you can look at it carefully once you leave the class, you essentially can see that these steps are computing the M star entries and they're doing power iteration. Okay, because after all, if you know the out degree, then you know if since the out degree is 4, then the probability is 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4. Now degree is 5 here, so 1/5, 1/5, 1/5, 1/5. And then if I give you a C, then using that, you do C times and 1 minus C times. Okay? This is a simple idea that you can do on a single CPU. Okay? My question now is, if I have many CPUs, how can I distribute this computation on many CPUs? The first question for MapReduce is how do I split this matrix? Now you can say one idea is I'll split up to 0, 1, etc. up to 100, that's one part, 101 to 200, another part, 201 to 300, that's another part. Now if you split that way, think about this, if you split that way, it does not give you MapReduce structure. But then you split the other way. What's the other way? You essentially say that you split this matrix into, let's say, 10 matrices. Okay? In the first one, the out degree is only taken for nodes between 1 to 100. The second one, 101 to 200. The third one, 201 to 300. So all of them would have every one of the nodes as the beginning nodes, but the destination will only be in a particular bucket. Now both of them are splitting. One actually works for MapReduce, one doesn't. And this is what I was saying in terms of, sometimes it's non-trivial as to how to convert your approach into something that will work with MapReduce. Okay. In this case, even if you, in fact, this particular thing is being taken from a paper on efficient computation on PageRank that I have mentioned, that actually is available from the readings list. And it was actually just done on a single CPU. It wasn't done on MapReduce, because this time, at that time, this guy was a grad student. You know, I didn't have MapReduce architecture. But even if you don't have MapReduce architecture, it's still worthwhile splitting the file, because if the entire file doesn't split in the memory or disk, then you need to essentially split it in such a way that parts of it split in the main memory at a time, such that you don't keep going back and forth between main memory and disk. So if you read this paper, you know, all the arguments as to why he is doing this, okay, which is basically I split this into, you know, bucket 0 to 31, bucket 32 to 63, bucket 64 to 95. And so basically this, you know, so for example, 0 going to 12, 26, 58, 94, in the first bucket only 12 and 26 are shown. In the second bucket, 58 is shown, the third bucket, 94 is shown. Okay, and he argues that the reason for this is basically because you don't have to go back into, you know, each of these, you know, split it into the number of blocks such that each block split, you know, fits in a main memory. That way you don't have to thrash between main memory and disk. Okay, but the same argument for MapReduce too. It split, you know, it can be assigned to individual, you know, CPUs. Okay, so once you split this, then here is a block-based PageRank algorithm which essentially computes both over individual buckets and merges them. I won't go into the details, you know, it's a pseudocode, you should be able to read this. Okay? And this way, each iteration involves a map, I mean, each iteration involves working on each of the buckets and combining the results. Okay? And it turns out that, you know, even at that time, this is much better, significantly better in terms of runtime. Okay, and then it also, this one can actually be used for implementation on a MapReduce architecture. Okay, so the point that I want you to remember, at least, you know, you should look at this code, this, you know, to make sure that you agree that the blocks are being used correctly. Okay, before that, you should actually look at this to make sure that when there is single block, you are computing the page rank correctly. Okay, and most importantly, I want you to understand that the way you are splitting the link matrix into multiple splits. And you could have done it in different ways, and this way is actually better. Okay. Now, a couple of other things about PageRank computation. This is from this particular experiment when it was done on Stanford web base, which was a publicly available web base. I believe it's still available right now. You can actually play with it. It used to have 25 million pages, okay, which is still better than 300 by 300 matrices that you play with normally. Okay, If you have 25 million pages and 81 million apparently URLs that are listed, okay, notice that you should understand that 81 is bigger than 25. That's okay, because each page might be pointing to pages that don't actually occur in the current web base. If you have the entire web, then this number cannot be bigger than this. But if you take a piece of the web, then there may be more URLs that are going out than you have. You know, some of the URLs are just going out of the web base. Okay, so here's the interesting question. Must I start with all the 25 million pages? So if I do 25 million pages, then basically this one has 0, etc., all the way up to 25 million. And for each of those pages, the outlinks. Okay, can I do, you know, some approximations to improve the performance even more? Okay, there was no approximation in what I did here. This is just efficient computation. You know, the page rank you get by doing it block-based is the same as page rank you would get if you just directly used the single matrix. There's no approximation. The only difference is you realize that disk seek is much, much higher than the memory, main memory seek, main memory access. Okay. Now we'll actually be ready to do some approximations. Okay. So one idea that they talk about, it is actually quite interesting, and that sort of goes back to, and I'm no longer, if I do this, then I'm no longer really computing page rank. Okay. But I'll be computing something that's faster to compute. Now, you might say, well, if all you wanted to do is compute something that's faster to compute, why not compute 1 plus 1, right? But, you know, that's too far an approximation, okay? So what we will do is essentially, what are you suggesting to do is remove the dangling nodes. Basically, dangling nodes are pages which have no children, which have no outgoing links. Remove them first. And when you remove them, then there may be other pages in the web base now which become childrenless because these other guys are gone. Remove them too.
But you will lose everybody if you keep removing.
No, you don't. No, you don't. Because, so think about this. A, B, C, okay, and D, and E, okay. A, B, C, and D, E. So I'll first remove E, then I can remove D. I still have this. Okay, essentially I will have a connected component, you know, hopefully a connected component left. Actually, this does not necessarily mean that I'll have a connected component. I could have had my entire graph was this plus another copy of this. Right, in which case, you know, while I'm removing this, then I would also remove this, and I'll have one component here left, one component here left. Okay, it'll still be like a normal page rank matrix, beginning of the page rank matrix, from which you still have to do your irreducibility, which means, you know, you should add a weak link from any page to any page in the remaining part. Okay, so his worry is unfounded. You know, removing danglers will not completely make it, you know, go out to zero. Okay, and these numbers are actually telling us a nice story that apparently he started with 25 million pages with 91 million URLs, and after these two prune iterations, that means remove all the dangling nodes and remove again all the dangling nodes, he got down to 19 million nodes. You're saying billion and above, I'm dead anyway, you know, but that's a different story. But at least he did reduce the size of the graph significantly. So now if you compute page rank on this, you're computing it on a much smaller matrix. Now, what's wrong with this picture? What happened to the guys who you removed? So first of all, here is an interesting question. In this graph, who is the most important guy? What?
A.
Why A? A is pointing to B, B is pointing to C.
E.
And I removed him. I removed all the important nodes to some extent. So what I'm removing actually, does it really make sense to remove dangling nodes? Are they somehow the less important nodes so that you can ignore them? No. In fact, the ones you're removing are likely to be more important than typical. However, what you can do essentially is you remove them, compute page rank on this. Okay? If you compute page rank on this, you sort of get one third, one third, one third. Okay? And then I can essentially assume that this is, if in fact after I remove these nodes, the remaining graph is large enough, then in essence, adding a few nodes back should not change the graph too much. Okay, so then what I will assume is I'll assume that the steady state probabilities I computed for ABC are remaining same even when I threw these guys in. So now if this guy is one third, is the steady state probability of being here. Okay, and if you are here with half probability you go here, half probability you go here. So the probability of being here is one sixth. Do you see what I'm saying? It's bogus in one sense, because in this case, this is a significant size of this matrix, this graph. But if this was like, you know, 25 million nodes, I mean like 19 million nodes, and I'm adding a few more nodes in that I removed before, then I can make this approximation. So the page rank I compute would not be the original page rank that I would have computed, but it would work. Now, I would give extra credit to anybody who would tell me something like this we have done in this class beforehand. Something pretty much similar. It's highly analogous. Reset matrix, no. Remember, connecting things across is the only way you live. Otherwise, you... What? No. Think outside page page rank. Yes. What? Why is that? No, no, that's not the one. No. No. I'm just sort of changing my view as to what should be the highest grade for this class. But go ahead. Please help me. Somebody. So basically, the point is the true page rank for this is not, yes, go ahead.
When you do semantic analysis, you throw back documents that were not originally and you include them in the...
No.
Yeah,
so
tell me
carefully what you said.
Okay.
You are in the general...
When you do semantic analysis,
mm-hmm.
you do it on a matrix of original documents. Then when you add documents to the corpus, you don't redo semantic analysis, but you project those to the new...
Actually, it's not the document, but the query. But the query. But he should get the credit. None of you came even close to LDA. So remember when you need to change your grade. just come and tell me. But that's the case in point, right? Because the true way to compute the map of the query in the factor space is to have put the query along with the documents, done the LDA, then the LSI. Okay? But that would, essentially mean that for every query, where every query you're going to do LSI separately. That's just going to kill you. It's already killing you, and now it's going to kill you even more, because for every query you're going to die. Okay? Instead, you are hoping that just adding one more query is not going to change the entire spread of the data, so that the access are not going to change too much. So it's like, if the original fish sheets were like this, right? Adding one more fish hopefully would not change the primary access. But on the other hand, if I get to add like 10,000 more fish, I can add them like this. And now it's completely changed. That's the same idea here. If you actually were to put these nodes in and compute the page rank, then the true page rank for these would not be 1/6. Okay? And furthermore, notice that all sorts of crazy things I'm doing here. 1/3 plus 1/3 plus 1/3 and then 1/6. So the probability is a little more than 1 now. All of those fun things get to happen. But that's a way you can approximate. Okay? You couldn't read this, but that's... You have to reintroduce dangling nodes and compute their page rank in terms of their fans. I mean, this guy's fan is this. C was D's fan, okay, because C was pointing to D, okay? And sometimes, actually, it could have been the case that B also was pointing to D. That's okay, too, because then it's 1/3 for B, 1/3 for C, so 1/6 plus 1/6, D will be 1/3 now. Now, notice that here the numbers are becoming significantly larger than 1, but had this part been much larger than 2, then it wouldn't have become significantly larger than 1. Okay? You're sort of assuming that the steady state is decided beforehand, and then these guys are not affecting the system too much. Yes?
So it's in a special case then?
What?
If that's significantly larger and you're cutting 2 nodes out, it's one thing. But if it's significantly larger and you're cutting 6 million nodes out,
Yeah, except that each of these 6 million nodes might be in different places still. Okay, and also they may not all have very high probabilities. Okay, you may be a dangling node without being a highly important node. All we know is some of the dangling nodes are highly important nodes. Okay, anyway, so that's kind of a neat trick that you try. Nobody, I don't know whether anybody does this. I mean, the only people who have to do PageRank is Google guys. Why do I need to care about it, right? And so, but it's interesting from a approximation point of view. Sometimes you do approximations, you know, because otherwise you can't compute the original quantity. Here is another idea, which is actually a more interesting idea, which is that, remember, the way the PageRank definition, PageRank iteration was defined, and this sort of comes back to somebody was asking whether reduce must be after map or not. Okay, it's connected here. So the way the PageRank was defined, you start with M0, you compute M1. You start with M1, you compute M2. You start with M2, you compute M3, until R0, compute R1, R1, compute R2, R2, compute R3, until, you know, Rn and Rn minus 1 are not different enough, in which case you have reached a fixed point. Right? Now, it's as if somehow everybody's page rank has to be taken to the second iteration before anybody's page rank is taken to the third iteration. That's what I'm saying. Is that really important? Okay, and in fact, you can argue that, in fact, one of the ideas you can use is that some nodes' page rank is updated more often than other nodes' page rank. And what you really would like to do is update the page rank of the nodes that will eventually be more important. Because the losers, why do you need to know the difference between 10 power minus 19 page rank and 10 power minus 19? You know, 10 power minus, 20 page rank. Okay? So one I could say is, as I'm doing this, I might want to actually focus on the more important pages first. In fact, this actually makes sense because the normal way you talk about the, so remember, if you have pages 1 to n, n being 8 billion or so pages, okay? And page rank is a vector, numbers here between 0 and 1. Okay. Now suppose this is Rn minus 1 and this is Rn. One way you compute the distance between these is essentially to say take the element wise differences, take the max of those differences, and you say that is the distance. Do you see what I'm saying? That's basically L infinity norm. Okay? And if you do that, in essence, who is going to affect that distance measure more? The guys who are more likely to be eventually important might have had less than their important measure in the previous iteration, and so the distance is becoming high. So if you get the important guys to get to their eventual page rank faster, then this convergence will occur faster. Okay, so all this is saying essentially is this idea essentially says that update the nodes based on the important ones. So first, in the beginning, everybody has the same steady state probability. And then after first iteration, then you get somebody has slightly higher probability than the others. The ones with higher probability, you update them more often. And if you do this, then, and if you count, if you look at the convergence rate, you see that convergence is better. The question is, who is the good guy, who is the bad guy in this? This has to be a good guy because this guy is converging to the lowest error much faster. This other guy does come to the lowest error, but much later. And this is iteration by iteration. And this is important guys get asynchronous iteration. So the first idea is called synchronous iteration. That means everybody's page rank is changed from one iteration to the next iteration to the next iteration. Whereas in this computation, somebody might have their page rank as according to 15th iteration, Some other guys might have page rank only according to third iteration. Okay, actually in this case, as long as each node is updated infinitely often, then you are guaranteed, there is a theoretical proof that you will get the same page rank that the original guy would have gotten. So this is actually a theoretically valid, there is no real approximation here. And this is sort of prioritized, you know, in some other areas this is called prioritized updating, prioritized sweeping, where your current page rank is used as the priority for deciding whether you get updated or not. Okay? And this way, by the way, one of the interesting things is this way you can do entire page rank in place. You don't need to. In a normal way of thinking of page rank is Rn minus 1, Rn, and then Rn, Rn plus 1, Rn plus 1, Rn plus 2. So you take the previous iteration, compute the next iteration. The way I am saying it, you change things in place. So you only need one vector ever. So the moment you compute, recompute one guy's page rank, you just, you know, change that number there, right there. Okay? So that's another very interesting way in which you can improve the speed. Okay? Any question? Yeah. No, I mean, all I'm saying is you just, the basic idea is if you have only one vector, in the beginning all of them are 1s. I mean, all of them are 1 over n. After one iteration, yeah, one full iteration, you know, somebody will have a higher page rank. It's, you know, it's not even necessary. All you can say is instead of thinking in terms of iteration to iteration, you can say which node should I update next. So I'll have, in the beginning, everybody's probability is 1 over n. So my heuristic for picking the node to update could be pick the node that is already important and then try to update it. And so in the beginning, all of them are equal. So, you know, and break ties randomly. All of them are equal, so anybody can be picked in the first one. Oh. The moment one guy has a slightly better rank than the other guys, then you start changing. Okay? Again, this is just, you know, this idea actually is anybody in this class who has heard of Markov decision processes? Okay. If you did, you know, it winds up being used there too. This is basically an idea of prioritized updating. Okay. I have a few more minutes, so maybe I can start introducing the next topic. Obviously, I can't do too much today, but let me introduce it so that you can start thinking about it, which is clustering. That's what I'm going to do today. The point about this is clustering actually is one of the more classical topics, in this course, okay. And of course, classical in computer science is sort of a iffy thing because computer science didn't exist. You know, in 1900s, the word computer meant a human being who does calculations. Okay, so I thought this, you know, essentially shows our predicament. These are Neanderthals and the early archaeologists, and he found this, and he's saying, I found this granite ball, and I think it's probably early July, because the history didn't exist before that. Okay, so when I say clustering is more classical topic, it's that it's, you know, compared to page rank on which the papers were being published in 1998, it's more classical, okay, not compared to, you know, the usual ADBC kind of standards. Okay, so the idea is that, let's see, I have a problem here. Okay, so clustering essentially is the process of grouping similar objects together. okay, and that's just a general idea. You can cluster anything. Okay, what I will do in 1.5 or so lectures here is talk about general clustering algorithms, some of the classical clustering algorithms, with an eye towards clustering text. Okay, so basically it turns out that all that you need about to understand clustering is distance between objects, and objects that are closer to each other are in one cluster, and as a group all those objects are far away from these objects, these are in a different cluster. Okay, as soon as you have a notion of distance, you can have a notion of clustering. Okay, of course, how do you define distance? We have, that depends on the domain that you are looking at. For text, the distance would be our similarity measure. You know, we could use vector similarity or Jaccard similarity, for example. Okay, with that in view, we will basically look at what would be, you know, how would classical clustering algorithms work for text. Now the question is, why do I care? That's mostly what I want to talk about today. Why do I care? Because in search, in IR, you might want to structure search results. So one, you know, instead of just saying here are the 100 results or here are the 1,000 results for your query, I can actually cluster these 1,000 results into three groups of varying sizes and say here is one cluster of results, here is another cluster of results, here is another cluster of results. Now, this could actually have the same effect, some of the same effect as the one that LSI and correlation analysis was trying to do. So for example, if I had said Bush, okay, there may have been in the top 1,000 results some number of George Bush results and some number of Kalahari Bushmen results. And hopefully if my clustering is good, it would have picked all the George Bush results and said one cluster, all the Kalahari Bush results and said another cluster. Okay, then if I show these two clusters to the user, in essence, if I did not know upfront which Bush he or she was talking about, now I provide both of them, and you know, whichever cluster they click on, that's the one from which I'll show more results. Okay, so in general, clustering is considered to be a good way of understanding the intent behind the queries. Okay, that's a very useful thing. Okay, the other interesting thing about clustering is that if you click a page, then if this page is part of another cluster of pages, then you might say you might be interested in these other pages in this cluster. Okay, a third idea is if you cluster pages, you can compute essentially taxonomy of pages on the web. You can compute the directory of the web. Okay, and then finally, if you cluster, then you can also use that to figure out essentially the topics, you know, of the pages, and then also sometimes look at which are likely to be closer to each other. Okay, so I think these two are very compelling applications. You want to cluster your search results. In fact, on part three, either I require or you get to do if you want in the part three of the project, clustering of search results. Okay. And that's one way you can figure out whether this thing actually works well or not. Okay, so one other question, of course, is, so there used to be the case that there were large number of search engines, but now obviously there are only two, and neither of them directly use clustering. Okay, but there used to be, I mean, some of them may still exist. This is from a while back. There used to be this search engine called Clusty, which would actually do exactly this, clustering. And there was another search engine called Manjara, which is again a prototype, which used latent semantic indexing followed by clustering. Okay, the idea is that if in fact the real representation of these documents is in the LSI space, then you should be looking at their distances in the LSI space, not in the normal space, because the distances in the normal space may not be telling you really the true distances. So they would do LSI on the top 1,000 results and then do clustering using one of the methods we'll talk about, k-means or something like that. Okay? And so that's basically what we are interested in doing clustering. Now, so in terms of when do you do clustering, you can do clustering at the indexing time. That means when you actually crawled all the documents into your corpus. and then you are constructing like the corpus, or you're constructing, you know, similar documents kind of clusters. Okay, you can also do it at the query time when you are essentially looking at, you know, putting all the George Bush results in one cluster and Kalahari Bushman results in a different cluster. Okay, and then the clustering can also be based in terms of the distances. The question, of course, is when you're talking about clustering, and we'll do this next class, you need to decide how do you define distance between pages. Okay, one obvious idea would be to define distance in terms of the text on those pages. But on the web, you can also use the link structure to decide distances between pages. So for example, two documents, both of which are pointing to the same 18 pages and are being pointed to by the same 17 pages, are probably similar, even if they don't think they are similar. Okay, so then that would be a link-based, so URL-based distance, text-based distance, which is what we'll mostly look at in the classes, but URL as well as the link-based distances can also be used. Okay, I'll stop here. Next class, I'll spend some time talking about, you know, general ideas of classical clustering and how to apply them to text.